Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Game Changer Lacrosse Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Uvoli. The Game Changer Lacrosse Podcast is about talking to people who have dedicated their life to the game of lacrosse and learning about who they are, how they got to where they are today, and what they do to improve themselves and their teams. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at GC Sports. And if you're a coach, a parent, or you run a travel or club team, check out Game Changer Team Manager in the App Store. It's the essential all-in-one scheduling and communication app for lacrosse coaches and parents. Unlike other team apps, Game Changer Team Manager is free, easy to use, and doesn't serve ads. You can learn more at gc.com/team manager. Today's guest needs no introduction. This is part one of my interview with Coach Tierney from Denver University. Coach Bill Tierney, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Joe. Glad to be on.
Awesome. Well, let's get started as I get started with all the other guests. What got you started in lacrosse?
Well, it was interesting. You know, I was a baseball player in high school, and then I got to Cortland State, where I went to college, and it was awfully cold, and my elbow was sore from throwing a lot of curveballs as a kid, and my roommate was a lacrosse goalie, so he handed me a stick instead and started shooting. I think back in those days, the great part about it was that we had freshman teams, so it was just freshmen competing at that point, and so a lot of guys could still back then start a sport like lacrosse and not feel overwhelmed that that it was just going to be too much of an uphill battle. In fact, on my freshman team, I think 9 of the 18 of us had played lacrosse before, so felt comfortable with that, loved the game, and became a passion. My goal when I went to college was to end up being the head football coach at my high school, Levittown Memorial, which I eventually became, but we'll talk about that later. And when that point came, I was too entrenched in lacrosse to stick with football.
I gotcha. So once you started playing, did it automatically become a passion? And what were some of the things that you did, to get better as a new player?
Well, it became a passion partly because of how great the game is, but also I always point to this one day in my life, which was after freshman year. I also played freshman football in college, and I showed up for the varsity football, preseason my sophomore year, and got stopped at the door by the head coach and told, "No, you're too small. You're done with football." So at that point, I had a choice to either bemoan that fact and go into a shell, or take that extra time that I now had for lacrosse and put it to good use. And thankfully, between some great friends like my best friend Ray Rostan and some other great guys that were around me, we got to work and were able to make the lacrosse team at Cortland from those years on.
Gotcha. And was it a situation where you were carrying the lacrosse stick around all the time, or would you just say it was something that you focused on school during the day, then you went to lacrosse and you were done with it?
Yeah, I think it stemmed from the fact that I still knew after freshman year that I was still behind. We had a lot of great players on our team and that were older and even in our year. And so we knew if we were going to even make the varsity team in our sophomore year, we had a lot of work to do. So it was pretty obsessive. We got after it and we spend a lot of time. There's a lot of cold nights at Cortland, but luckily we found a way to sneak into the field house at midnight and turn one light on and play little games to help our sticks get better. And was blessed that Coach Emmer saw something in me to keep me on the team that year.
Gotcha. Very cool. Very cool. So it sounds like you weren't recruited for lacrosse, but what made you actually decide to go to Cortland?
Well, I went to Cortland for a lot of reasons. Number one, I knew I wanted to be a physical education teacher, and I wanted to coach. So those two things were a given. As I mentioned earlier, I was at that point thinking more along the football lines. My older sister was at Springfield College at the time, and she was a physical education major. And at the time, Springfield cost $3,000 and Cortland cost $2,100. So that and the fact that when I visited Cortland, a really nice looking beautiful woman told me I should go there. And so probably for a lot of reasons, decided on Cortland and thankful and feel blessed to have attended such a great place.
Gotcha. Sounds like you made the right decision. So it sounds like coaching was something that that you wanted to do for a very long time. When did you realize that you wanted to get started with coaching?
Well, it's funny. My a lot of us that grew up in Levittown, our parents worked very hard. My mom was a school nurse and my dad was a beer truck driver. And all my dad wanted me to do was go to college. He thought I should be an accountant, but because I was good in math. But in that process of growing up, whether it had been little league baseball or midget basketball, or in my memory, clearest memory was midget football, and then all the way through junior high and high school to my coaches in those sports, especially Phil Wolf and Nick Belitsis at Levittown Memorial, and having all these great coaches throughout. I knew how much they had impacted me, and I knew that was the way I wanted to go. I knew I wanted to teach, and I thought it would be fun, but my real passion was I wanted to coach kids, and that stemmed from the great coaches I have had growing up.
Gotcha. Do you remember the moment when it sort of clicked for you that, yeah, I want to go forward and be a lacrosse coach?
A lacrosse coach? Yeah, I guess so. It was interesting. As I mentioned, I spent 4 years in college playing lacrosse, 1 year playing football and getting cut then after that. Mm-hmm. Still coached football. I student taught and coached at Ithaca High School. I volunteered over at Cortland High School. And so I still had that football thing in my mind, and then loved coaching them both when I got out of school, really. I guess it was because we became a little more successful in lacrosse at an earlier time. Eventually in the fall of 1981, I became the head football coach at Levittown Memorial. And by that time, my passion for lacrosse was just so great that when, again, my best friend, Ray Rostand, was the head coach at RIT, he left late in that summer to go over to Ithaca College. And so the job at RIT opened in December of that year. So after finally 1 year of being head football coach, got an opportunity because no one else, not a lot of guys could apply for a college coaching job in December. Through Ray's recommendation, through some guys that you may remember the names, Eddie Purcell, Tom Sill, some of these guys were already at RIT, so they pushed the AD to hire me, and had my oldest daughter Courtney was 2 weeks old, and so I had the two boys, so I had a wife and three children, all under the age of three, and we moved to Rochester, New York in January. So I guess the passion, it was pretty clear there that I wanted to be a college lacrosse coach.
Gotcha. So let's back up a little bit. When when you graduated Cortland, you were part of that national championship team there, and then you went on to coach high school. You went on to coach high school lacrosse. Basically, were you just modeling your coaching after like Coach Phil Wolf and Coach Emmer, or were you were there other coaches that you looked up to and modeled your coaching after at that point?
Yeah, I think when you play for Coach Emmer, you become a model of his style very quickly. He was detailed, to the point, very tough, but also very caring of his players. So I was blessed to have Coach Emmer for 2 years, and then he left for the Washington and Lee, and Coach Chuck Winters took over my senior year, and we won a national championship that year, as you mentioned. But and then when I started coaching, I was really lucky. Buddy Krumenacker, who still to this day is the head football coach at Farmingdale High School, hired me as his assistant lacrosse coach at Great Neck South, and it was under his tutelage that I really got my feet wet as a high school coach. and then played 1 year of pro lacrosse, and then four years was lucky to get hired at Great Neck South to be the head coach before coming back to Levittown Memorial and being their head lacrosse coach for 2 years. So and through those years, with the inspiration of Coach Ammer, Coach Winters, and then what Buddy taught me about being a high school coach, you know, I think all those things started getting me on the path of developing, partly from what I learned from those coaches and also partly from kind of what I taught myself as a bench warmer at Cortland for most of my time, that, on how to motivate and how to get guys to do the right things, and, mm-hmm. and learned a lot about the X's and O's as well.
Yeah. Did you ever reach out to these coaches, while you were sort of learning the ropes, in sort of like a mentor capacity?
Sure. I mean, the beauty of lacrosse is that it's, and still to this day, I'm thankful that it's the same way, is that, young high school coaches, can reach out to other coaches. But when I was back there, you had Joe Cuzzo and you had Bobby Hartrath at Farmingdale, and Joe at Ward Melville, Fran McCall at Bethpage, all these guys that you could always ask questions to. Certainly calls to Coach Emmer and Coach Winters, when I became a head coach. And by then, haven't played on Long Island with the Long Island Lacrosse Club, and now you're talking about guys like Alan Lowe and Stan Kowalski and all these guys. There was just so many men that you could turn to that it made you feel, I was still young enough to play, so you could get to know those guys better. But everybody had ideas, and it allowed you to develop your own ideas. But I as you know, Joe, a lot of lacrosse. Or not much of lacrosse, I guess I'd say, is original ideas. We all steal from each other and then put our own little touch on it. And so I was blessed to have all those men be willing to be mentors of me. Especially Buddy in those days.
That's cool. Yeah, that's definitely the best part about lacrosse is, and it's sort of been shown to me over these past couple of weeks as I've been putting the podcast together, reaching out to literally anybody that I knew over the past 10, 15 years, yourself included. You reach out, and I immediately got a response back from most people being like, yep, yeah, no problem, we can talk whenever you want to. And it's just, lacrosse is such a tight-knit community that you can reach out to anyone and get help and information from somebody at any time. It really makes it a great sport.
Yeah, no question. Yeah. No question about that.
So let's sort of go not to your first head coaching job in college. I want to talk about your assistant coaching job while you were at JHU for a few years. An assistant coach, you sort of went to the head coach in college, then you went back to the assistant in JHU. What were some of the things that you learned those first few years as an assistant coach at Hopkins?
Well, I hadn't been an assistant except for that 1 year in high school back in 74. So I had been a head coach, and in those days you didn't have a lot of assistant coaches. So my 3 years at RIT, I had a guy named Mike Greco who was my part-time assistant, but basically doing everything by myself. So mm-hmm. getting to Hopkins, and then all of a sudden, I think we had 9 or 10 coaches on our staff at that point. I was, in quotes, the first assistant coach, but the truth of the matter was I was the 10th most important coach. And every one of those guys went to Hopkins, and so I had a lot to learn. I didn't realize how much lacrosse I didn't know until my first conversation with Freddie Smith. And a lot of people don't know about Freddie Smith, but in my mind, Freddie Smith is the best defensive coach to ever walk the earth. And at the time, Freddie, when I took the job at Hopkins, Freddie was about 60 years old. And unfortunately, in our final year in 87, when we won the national championship, Freddie passed away that summer. But I learned a lot, so much about lacrosse in general, just the X's and O's stuff, but also about being under someone else. Coach Zimmerman, I'll always be indebted to Don and Bob Scott, who was the AD at the time, for hiring me at Hopkins. Mm-hmm. But I also had to be a soccer coach there, and I didn't know anything about soccer. know, and so that was an interesting part of my assistant coach's experience at Hopkins, was being the head soccer coach. And I think had just as much of an impact on me getting the job at Princeton as my lacrosse coaching did at Hopkins, because other than my last year at Hopkins when Freddie was sick, I was really good at picking up balls and listening to guys and you know, helping with scouting reports and stuff, but my input wasn't that great, you know. So I think I always tell people the most important thing I learned as an assistant coach at Hopkins is to trust my assistants. You know, I tell my assistants all the time that all I ask you to do is, if you don't agree with me with something, come into the office, let's battle it out, let's talk it out. I'll always give you guys the benefit of the doubt, I'll go with your ideas. But either way, when we get out on that field, we got to be singing the same song. And Don Zimmerman taught me that. Those other coaches taught me that. There were lots of things that I didn't know when I was there that I maybe didn't agree with. In fact, I remember presenting to Zim what eventually became known as the Princeton defense. And at the time, it was the wrong thing for Hopkins, but he listened to all that and input from Freddie and all that just made me a better coach. And so knowing what it was like to be an assistant, win 2 of 3 national championships those 3 years, allowed me to be confident as a head coach that I would always respect my assistant coaches, their family life, their beliefs, and also respect them that they, you know, there's lots of ways to skin this cat, and young guys have great ideas too. And hence, I think all those assistants I had at Princeton, and then certainly with Trevor and Matt Brown here and Dylan Sheridan and now John Orson, I feel very confident that I've given them, leeway enough to express their ideas, feel like they've had impact on our program, and for me to learn from them as well.
Gotcha. So you said something that I'm very interested in and I want to touch on a little bit. You mentioned you approach Coach Zimmerman with what would be known as the Princeton defense. So that means that you came up with the idea for that defense while you were an assistant coach. How did that come about?
Well, it's interesting. When I was at Levittown, kind of developed this defense just because we had some great players, you know, Eddie Purcell and Tommy Sill and all these midfielders. We had just a bunch of great athletes, a lot of college lacrosse playing guys, and Larry Quinn in the goal. I feel blessed to have coached who I believe are the two best goalies that ever played the game, and Larry Quinn and Scott Bacigalupo. So, and I was more blessed with Larry because I had him as my high school goalie for 2 years. When I was at Levittown, what we used to do was a little bit different than the quotes Princeton defense was. We never let a guy run more than 2 or 3 steps with the ball without double teaming him from his backside. And so the rule was, if you saw a guy's big numbers and he had the ball, you just went and double teamed him. And we were switching hands with the defenseman. We were rolling him back to the middle. Everything that you could do was wrong, except we put a lot of pressure on guys through slides and double teams. Mm-hmm. Then fast forward to my years, and I did the same thing at RIT, and we were pretty successful there too. Mm-hmm. But then when I got to Hopkins, I learned from Freddie about, being a little bit more sane. Hopkins at the time, and played what they call the 7 defense, which includes the 6 defensive players and the goalie being a part of that.
Yep.
And this idea of sliding from the crease, hopefully having guys go down the side a little bit, forcing the inside roll and coming across the crease. So I got a little of that from Freddie. And so when I finally got my chance at Princeton, my first 2 years, I tried to stick with the Hopkins defense, but we found out very quickly in my first couple of years at Princeton, we just didn't have the talent to do that. So I instituted kind of a hybrid of Freddie's 7 defense with my concept of early, high-pressure slides and double teams, and it eventually worked into being the Princeton defense.
Very cool. I'm curious, could you Could you go a little bit deeper into what you would consider your defensive style? Because from what I remember, it's more about, well, so for example, I remember watching you, I remember watching you coach the USA team. I think it was 98. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep.
I remember going to one of your practices, and I remember, I actually think it was the first one. It was at Farmingdale and
Farmingdale College. Exactly.
Yeah. Yep. And you had, I guess you brought the team together and you started off with one-on-ones. And everybody, you know, was trying to look great. They're all being overly aggressive. And you stopped the one-on-ones after a couple ones. And you basically went against, I forgot who went against you, but you said, all right, hey, I'm gonna guard you. And basically what you did was you just forced them down an alley. You basically just forced them down the side. And then I remember you said, what I just did there was better than anything you guys have done since you've been out here. And that basically, I mean, that stuck in my head because that made it seem like there's a very simple way to play defense. It's not about being aggressive. It's not about attacking the guy that you're going after. It's about basically controlling him and trying to make him do what you want him to do. Is that correct? Is that basically how you would sum up your individual defense?
You're amazing me, Joe, because I think you are the only, you and I are the only guys that remember that. I'll add one more piece. I'll add one more piece of that because I know exactly what happened. At the time, we weren't sure if Casey Powell was going to play midfield for us or attack.
Mm-hmm.
And so my point of emphasis to these guys was Casey at the time was playing attack, and I wanted to show them how ridiculously easy it was. I said, Casey, you come here and play defense. After I demonstrated what you said,
yep.
I said, Casey, you come here and play defense. All you have to do now is make sure that guy gets down the side.
Yep.
And Casey Powell, one of the greatest offensive players to ever play the game, and he's still proving that point,
yep.
Stood there. The guy dodged him. He gave him a little bump, and the guy went down the side. And I looked at the rest, and I said, there you go.
Casey
can do it. You can all do it. Now, the caveat to the story is I had a lot of guys I respected on that team, John DiTomaso and Pat McCabe and Brian Volker and Joe Bresci.
Mm-hmm.
And we eventually got to the point where in the short amount of time we had, I couldn't teach a college defense to, in quotes, pros. There was no pro league at the time, but the best club players out there. So we came to a real happy medium with that team. Because we knew that Volks and those guys were going to have to cover the gates, so we came to that. But you're absolutely right. Your memory's great. Is that that defense starts every time? Every year we start with teaching that defense. It starts with a one-on-one, and it starts with that exact same message that you don't have to cover your guy. All you have to do is get them where we want them.
Yeah, yeah. I remember that moment very well. Well, specifically because I was an attackman, and I remember thinking at that moment, actually, I learned something at that moment because it was the first time that I ever really heard somebody speak from the other side where, somebody's teaching defense rather than offense. And it stuck in my mind that if I actually, if I learned what the defense wanted me to do, I have an advantage right there. I'll never forget that moment for as long as I live. It was such an impactful part of my lacrosse career. But anyway, I want to go back to, while you were an assistant coach. So I'm curious, it sounded like, you were obviously putting your ideas forward and obviously anybody who's an assistant coach, I'd say 99% of them, they want to move up and they want to become a head coach. So this is sort of a two-part question. One, what would you consider makes a good assistant coach? And then what would you recommend to coaches that are assistant coaches right now and want to move up? How do you recommend, what steps do you recommend they take to sort of get that head coaching job?
It's maybe one of the best questions I've ever been asked, Joe. It's really important that the first and foremost, and this will always be the case if they want this scenario to work, like you said, first and foremost, being loyal to the head coach,
mm-hmm.
even at the times where you disagree with them. Because the assistant coaches that think they're smarter than the head coaches, or the assistant coaches to go out on the field and start saying things to the kids that might cut you know, to the integrity of the head coach because they think that's cool or that might make them more popular with those players, they're not going to last long. They're not going to last long in life. They're not going to last long as a head coach. They're not going to, because what goes around comes around. If you act like that, you're going to get it, you know, at some point. So that's number one's loyalty. Mm-hmm. Number two is don't be a yes man. Mm-hmm. And understand that if the guy who's your head coach is worth half his weight, that when you're in the office and you're watching film or you got an idea and you present it to him, you got to be ready to present, not only present new ideas to him, but be ready to argue those points. So be good at what you're doing, but also don't be a yes man. If you can, you know, be loyal, don't be a yes man, and then be patient and understand that it takes time. These things take time. They're the way the lacrosse world is built, and you could draw a simple triangle. There are, you know, 100 more of Division III coaches, and then Division II coaches, and then the Division I thing becomes a real, you know, real slim point of the triangle.
Yep.
And us older guys, we're not going to leave real quick unless we get forced to leave, you know. Mm-hmm. So you got to be patient. You've got to be willing to move anywhere. Well, I remember when I came home from that interview at RIT around December 20th, you know, as I said, my wife was 9 months pregnant, ready to have a baby. And we both grew up on Long Island. Everything was good. I was a head football coach, head lacrosse coach at a great high school. I was around my friends. And I told her we're moving to Rochester, New York on January 29th, which is about the worst time you can ever move to upstate New York, as you know. But, you know, that could have been the end. But you know, nobody, Ray had done a great job at RIT starting to build the program. I knew we could do well. I knew some of the players that were there. And as an assistant coach, you can't, don't be picky. You know, there's steps to it. You got to take on programs that maybe aren't as good as you thought they were or as good as you want the one to be. Mm-hmm. Take pride in building programs. But most of all, I think, is, you know, get the experience for your athletes, the ones that you're coaching at that time, and put your heart and soul into those kids.
Gotcha.
And if you do that, all those traits are going to come back and make you stronger because you're going to go through some ups and downs, but they're also going to make you a head coach eventually, make you a better head coach because you'll understand what your assistant coaches are going through.
Yep. Awesome. That's great. All right. So, yeah, I want to move forward to your first term as head coach. This is RIT in 1982. You know, sort of not your first head coaching job. Obviously, you were a head coach in high school, but this is your first head coaching job in college. That first time around, what were some of the lessons that you learned that first year?
Well, so many. I had to learn how to do 6 weeks of preseason in a gym between 10 at night and midnight, and then be up every morning for an 8 o'clock conditioning class because I had to teach phys ed at the time.
Okay.
So number one, I had to learn how to get on with not much sleep. But I think obviously the biggest thing was recruiting. You know, I had never done recruiting. You know, when you're in high school, you get the kids you get.
Yeah.
And so never been that. So I had to get right to work in high school in recruiting and went right back to my roots. I remember my first recruiting trip was to Levittown Memorial, was to Levittown Division, was to Massapequa, you know, all these places that I knew, and Farmingdale.
Yep.
And I actually got some kids out of those places. Mm-hmm. So I think that was the biggest part of learning that. You know, just being out there and having to know that I had to pretty much do everything. And as I said, practicing in a gym was a kind of a new experience, especially for 6 week term. So we had to make up a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. I remember going upstairs my first night of practice. I had been in Rochester for 2 days and walked into the gym, and luckily Eddie Purcell, whose son Ryan plays for me now here at here at Denver, mm-hmm. Eddie Purcell and Tommy Sill, who had played for me at Levittown. I walked up to the gym. I looked at this this crew of ragamuffins. I had guys with bandanas on. I had guys with shorts over their sweats. Mm-hmm. I had guys with cleats on in the gym. I had guys with sticks that looked like they were falling apart. And I called Eddie and Tommy over and I said, I'm going downstairs for the next 15 minutes. You tell these guys what the rules are about bandana and hair and wearing shorts over their sweats. And I'm going to come back up and it better look different. Now, these were two freshmen at the time that were only there like 4 months, but they knew my act. And so, you know, we had to get through some rough spots. And but thankfully, Ray had left the talent of the program was much better than I thought. And we ended up doing real well those 3 years, the last 2 years making the NCAA tournament, the final year making the Final Four of Division III back then. And you know, you learn so much. It's a sharp learning curve when you're the only guy around and the only first time you've been in college coaching.
Yeah. It seems like you have a knack for, you know, when I look at your coaching career in college, it seems like you have a knack of going to a school that's underdeveloped and turning it around. We'll get to that in a second. But I'm curious because there's one question that I've asked a lot of the people who have been on the podcast, and I always get the best answers from this, and it's mostly been in their playing career. But I'm interested what your answer would be as a coach. Since RIT was your first coaching job, if you were to go back and do that over, what were some of the things that you wish you can do again or do differently?
Well, certainly some of the things I would do differently, and you've seen me, Joe, and I've known your family forever, is I wouldn't have said some of the things that I've said to some of the young men I've coached over the years. It's pretty embarrassing, you know, whether it's RIT or Hopkins or Princeton and even some of the guys here at Denver, although I've gotten better, that when they say things that you said to them, and you look at them and go, I never said that. And then five of the others look at you and say, oh, yeah, you did, coach. And so somewhat embarrassing. But I think I was so blessed in every job I had to recognize, if I've got a trait, it's to recognize how lucky I have been in my career, how lucky I've been every day in my life with my family, with my children, with my jobs, with everything I've had, that it's, you know, certainly you made mistakes. Certainly there were things that, you know, you acted out on. I remember at RIT one time we lost a tough game and I started going around the locker room telling each guy individually how he screwed the team. And I got to about the fourth or fifth guy, and I'm just going, this is wrong. Yeah. This is wrong. And so I just stopped. Mm-hmm. And I just said, okay, let's just move on. You know, we stunk that day, and let's move on. And I think I learned a lesson from that. You know, to make general statements in public, and then if you have an individual thing to say, bring the kid into the office and talk to him about that.
Gotcha.
But, just lots of things you would look back as far as game day operations, game day strategies, you know, all those. But I think that goes hand in hand with being a coach, and I think that goes with you're gonna make mistakes here and there.
Yeah.
And just knowing that if you love your kids, even to them, sometimes it doesn't seem like love.
Yeah.
You know, when you bet them, or you leave them home from a trip, or you make them go to class, or you suspend them for alcohol or something like that, that if you love your players, real love, that everything's going to be okay.
Yep. And that's sort of where, you know, to go to your earlier point where you said you take back some of the things that you say on the sideline, that's all coming from a passion. It's not coming from, you know, from a bad place, or to actually, you don't actually mean those things. You're so fired up and saying certain things on the sideline because you love your kids and you love the game. You want to win. Is that right?
Yeah. No question. And you want them, in my own stupid way back then when I was 30 years old, you know, you want them to be better people from having played for you. Mm-hmm. And, and it's really less in games really than in practice. Because practice, you get the repetitions over and over again, and you see so many more mistakes in practice than hopefully in games. And so, that probably is my greatest regret with some of those things. But I think even those kids, as you said, they know you're passionate. They know you're pulling for them. And as long as they have, you know, meaningful careers and great friendships and great memories from it, they forgive some of your stupidity as you get older.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, so let's move on to when you take over Princeton. So like I mentioned, it's a underdeveloped program. But at this point in your career, you had over 10 years of coaching experience. What were some of the goals and some of the things that you tried to take into this program? How did you approach that challenge?
Well, I think two things. Number one, you mentioned it, that I had kind of built a resume on turning programs around or getting better results than they had previously had. Mm-hmm. And obviously that didn't happen at Hopkins with lacrosse, but it happened with soccer. And I think that the people at Princeton, when they hired me, they knew I was a member of the Hopkins lacrosse staff. Bob Meislick, who was my AD, who hired me, saw us win the national championship in 1987. At Rutgers, so he saw that game against Cornell, saw us beat Maryland in the semifinals. And so they knew there was a lacrosse background, but Hopkins, and when I took over at Hopkins' soccer program, they had one winning year in 50 years of soccer. Hmm. And my last 2 years, we went 14-3 and made the NCAA tournament in my last year. So I think they felt like there was something to helping turn around a program, and what I called it was my blueprint for turning around a program. And number one, as I told them, it starts with discipline. And I told the kids here that when I came to Denver, all those years later. And so, Princeton had an amazing history of lacrosse. They had won national championships in the 40s, 50s, 60s. And then it kind of had fallen on some harder times in the 70s. And then had great results in the Ivy League for the first 20 years of Ivy League lacrosse play. Mm-hmm. And then fell on some hard times. And so I knew there was a history there. I knew, unlike, say, here at Denver, where you had 100 years of lacrosse history at Princeton. And for the most part, it was good. So you could call on those people to be supportive. You could call on those people to be financially supportive. Mm-hmm. One of the amazing things about Princeton University is that everybody that goes there recognizes that how blessed they are, and giving back to the program or to the school is part of their expectation. And so I felt like our core was there. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a hell of a lot of talent, when I first got there. And so I knew then step two after discipline was what I mentioned before, was recruiting. You got to go out and get there. And I went into some homes of some young men. My first recruit was Justin Tortolani, who's one of the premier spinal surgeons now in Baltimore. And guy after guy after guy, I just went in and sold them on Princeton, because I couldn't promise them a heck of a lot. As far as the past of lacrosse. But I told them, and Mike Mariano, who told this story after we won the 92 national championship, and my first recruits were seniors, he said that I said in our first meeting that we're going to win a national championship. Huh. And I said that, I guess, but God knows if I believed it or not.
Yeah.
So I think just having gone... going way back to Great Neck South. If you go into the Great Neck South gym right now, there's still one league championship in lacrosse there, and that was in 1979. And then you go to RIT, and Ray had done a great job building it, but they had never been to an NCAA tournament, and we had three great years there. Hopkins soccer, and then you just go through the career. I had just been very lucky to have those opportunities to help the program get a little bit better. I had a blueprint for it. Mm-hmm. And luckily at the time when I got to Princeton, it was the right time and the right place to impart those ways, so to speak, with a lot of support, an amazing school and a great place. And we were able to get it done pretty quickly.
So I'll ask you more about the blueprint in a second, but I'm curious because this has always stuck out to me. If you don't mind, could you dive a little deeper into how you went about recruiting those first couple years? Because I would imagine that, yeah, that is a pretty tough sell when you're, you know, trying to get the top kids in the nation to come to a school that, you know, for years and years hasn't been to a national championship game or a Final Four. How do you approach that? What's your mindset? I mean, obviously, it's easy to recruit for a school like Princeton from the academic point of view, but how do you do it from talking to a kid who wants to play lacrosse at college and wants to win a national championship? How do you get them to come to a team that hasn't really shown a history of that?
Well, you know, first and foremost was what you said. First and foremost, I said, hey, even if this doesn't work, you're going to get a degree from the greatest undergraduate school in the country. So mm-hmm. that was first and foremost because all the kids had to be great students.
Yeah.
But what I looked for is my first rule was don't recruit anybody out of a losing program. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't have club teams back then. It was all high school. Mm-hmm. So you had, Justin and Mal Maestro from Manhasset. You know, those guys just, where was I going to go to? You know,
yeah.
Why not go to Manhasset from Princeton? You know, mm-hmm. it made so much sense. You know, start with that. So number one, it was kids from winning programs. Mm-hmm. Number two, it was kids that had a little bit of a chip on their shoulder that the big boys didn't recruit them. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember some of the guys, back then, you know, Cornell was in its heyday, and there were a couple of our guys, Greg Waller, Mike Mariano, some of those guys, they were a little upset that they didn't get recruited by Cornell. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I tried to play that factor. Mm-hmm. So number one, winning teams. Number two, guys with a little bit of a chip on their shoulder, maybe felt like they were overlooked, in the process. Maybe, you know, I could play up that, maybe that coach doesn't think you're so good from some of those other teams. But I think you're great, you know.
Yeah.
And then number three, playing time. Look, we've won four Ivy League games in the last 4 years. You're going to come in here and you're going to start as freshmen. I can promise you that because there's not a lot. We had some good players that were in the program at the time, Rob Palumbo and a lot of those guys were good players, but not a lot of them.
Yeah.
We had Paul DiBello was a really good midfielder and stuff. And so now you're talking about passion, you're talking about winners, you're talking about guys with a chip on their shoulder, you're talking about letting them play, you're talking about going to a great school. I talked to them about myself and how I had experience building, taking programs from being a little downtrodden to going to being the best. Mm-hmm. And I told them we're gonna win. We're gonna win with you being a major, major part of this. And then, of course, you talk about the normal recruiting stuff, the beautiful campus, the locale for a lot of those guys was within 2 hours, the Baltimore guys, the Long Island guys. It was a great location. Mm-hmm. I promised them we'd play a great schedule. We opened up with Hopkins every year. We had the Ivy League. All those teams were really good. I told them they'd play against the best, and if we took some lumps, we'd take some lumps. But I just tried to get them excited about picturing themselves in a program that they were going to have a huge part of resurrecting.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. That's great advice. And I would imagine, especially the part about the chip on your shoulder, that advice is even more relevant today as the player pool, just
no
gets
question.
Bigger and bigger.
We're still doing the same now, you know, the big boys don't want you. Come on out to Denver.
All right. So, I believe these numbers are accurate. I'm sure you don't have them written down anywhere, but so it looks like you're 30-12 in NCAA tournament games, and of those games, you're 14-4 in one goal games. That's really unbelievable when you look at those numbers. How do you prepare your teams to win those close games, those one goal games?
That's funny, Joe. When I remember when we won the last national championship at Princeton in 2001. As you know, my son Trevor was our goalie at the played a great game, beat Syracuse in overtime. And I remember going to the post game, media thing, and And one of the reporters asked Trevor that exact question. He said, you know, it was of our six national championships, four were in overtime and, you know, obviously one goal games with a few more one goalers in there to get to the, to get there. And with Trevor's answer, that probably much better than my answer could be, was he makes life so miserable in practice that that the games are fun. And we know that there's never going to be as much pressure in a game as there is in practice. And I thought that was pretty cool, you know, from a 21-year-old to especially whose dad was sitting down the table from him, you know, to put it in that kind of perspective. I think if, you know, clearly there's so much pressure now, and there's so much, there's so many great coaches, so many great teams and great with great players, that there's going to be a lot of one goal games. And so, you know, not panicking in when those situations come up, preparing them beforehand that they might come up. Yeah. You know, we always say every game before we play, we say, okay, let's get ready for 60 great minutes or more. Mm-hmm. And be ready to go, and know that it could be close. These teams want to play against you. You want to play against them, and it could be close. Just stay poised. Do the things we do in practice, and good things will happen. Yeah.
So how are you raising the stakes in practice? Can you go into a little bit more about how you make it miserable for them?
Sorry to leave you hanging with a little bit of a cliffhanger, but come back to hear the second part and the conclusion of my interview with Coach Tierney. Thanks for listening to today's episode of the Game Changer Lacrosse Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Uvoli. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Uvoli. You can find more episodes of the Game Changer Lacrosse Podcast on The Season at theseason.gc.com. If you like the podcast, please take a second to give it a positive review on iTunes. This helps more people find the podcast. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at GC Sports. And if you're a coach, a parent, or you run a travel or club team, check out Game Changer Team Manager in the App Store. It's an essential all-in-one scheduling and communication app for lacrosse coaches and parents. Game Changer Team Manager is free, it's easy to use, and it doesn't serve ads. Learn more at gc.com/team manager. Until next time, keep working and keep getting better.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.